Hey everyone, welcome back to the Bible in Context. Hey Nate.
How are you doing, Caleb?
Doing good. We're going to jump into chapter 19 finally and finish up Lot's story. So before we do that, you want to give us a little recap of Lot's life?
Yeah. I think it's good to just kind of recall where we have been with Lot. We were actually first introduced to Lot in chapter 11, where we learned that Lot's father had passed away, and so Abraham's father took care of him. So that means Abraham probably watched him grow up, maybe even helped raise him at some point. Then in chapter 13, we learned that Lot had become very wealthy, more than likely because he had followed Abraham and experienced God's blessing. And so he becomes so wealthy that him and Abraham could not be in the same location. The land just wouldn't sustain both of their family with all their flocks. And so like the herdsmen started arguing with each other. And so Abraham tells Lot to choose a place to live where he could move far enough away so that their families could both continue to prosper. And unfortunately, Lot chose to move into the Jordan Valley. And he said because it looked lush, and in fact the narrator compared it to the Garden of Eden. And so the text says that he moved his tent as far as Sodom. And it calls the men of Sodom wicked. They were great sinners against Yahweh. And this leads us to the next chapter, Genesis, where Lot gets swept up in this war that breaks out in the Jordan Valley between nine evil empires. Lot becomes a prisoner in that war, and Abraham goes and gathers a small army and rescues him and drives away the invading armies. And then we don't hear about Lot again until here in chapter 19. And so you want to talk about the context of what's going on here?
Yeah. So we dove into him a little bit last week, where he's sitting in the gate at Sodom. So the whole time he's just been, you know, chilling here at Sodom. And it seems like possibly he's become a kind of a judge in this city, where he's sitting in the gate like the judges of Israel may do. So that's probably a hint at his righteousness or the fact that he has gained some kind of respect or authority. Maybe not. Maybe just for the sake of the story, he's just happens to be here. But I think it makes sense that the story is trying to portray him as a righteous judge.
Typically where like the prominent men of the city would hang out.
Yeah. You see that with like Boaz and
right.
Ruth.
Yeah.
So yeah, we talked about how he is sitting in the gate. These two angels come to him and he bows down just like Abraham bowed to Yahweh and these two men. He calls them lords or masters. It's not the word Yahweh. It's the word actual Lord. And then we're going to see how his story really becomes a parody of Abram's loyalty and of the Exodus and of Passover.
And do you think there's some parody with Noah also that we see in here?
How so?
Let me give you a few things.
Okay.
All right. So Noah's story begins with spiritual beings coming to earth to have sexual relationships with women.
Oh, yeah. Mm, okay.
In Lot's story, spiritual beings come to visit him, and the men of Sodom want to have relations with them. You also see both Noah and Lot find favor in the eyes of the Lord. Both Noah and Lot are considered righteous men, even though they do foolish things. We see in both of their stories God's judgment and destruction. In the flood, God brings rain down, and we may even talk about that word rain.
We'll
get there in a second. In Sodom and Gomorrah, God rains down sulfur and fire, and in both stories, there's an emphasis on all the living things being destroyed. In both the stories, God preserves them in their family from the destruction. So in the flood story, the Lord shut the door on the ark. And so in Lot's story, the angel pulls Lot into the house and shut the door. Same language. With Noah, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Lot is encouraged to escape to the hills, it says, but it's the same word for mountains.
Yeah.
And we're going to see that both Noah and Lot, after God rescued them, get drunk. Both Noah's children and Lot's children sin after that and somewhat similar ways.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, very. You know, I noticed these things like individually throughout the narrative.
Yeah.
Most, most of those things at least, but I hadn't strung them together to like draw this tight comparison between the two, but they are.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Well, and you've mentioned before that both Noah and Lot have illegitimate children who become their children become nations that have become hostile towards Israel.
After getting drunk and then having something illicit happen. And
So there's a lot of parallels there with and Noah, too.
They're both, like, essentially, Noah is the only righteous in his generation, and Lot is the only righteous in this city.
In the city, right.
So,
right.
Yeah, wow, he's kind of a new parody of Noah. You're right. Very cool. We see Lot is going to parody Noah, and then he's going to parody Abram and his loyalty, and then he's going to have this parody of also Passover and the Exodus. So, yeah, we'll walk through it, and we'll bring up some of those points that Nate just mentioned again as we're going through the narrative, and then we'll do the same thing with these other narrative elements that we just mentioned. So, the first thing is where he starts to mimic Abraham. So, after Lot meets these two angels at the gate, he brings them home, and after convincing them to come to his dwelling, and we mentioned last week that he makes them unleavened bread, which, first of all, this mimics the feast that Abraham just gave to these two angels in Yahweh, which was, I mean, a kingly feast. It was massive, way too much for these men because it was a gift and a feast, whereas Lot is giving kind of, not quite leftovers, but it's not something great. He's offering ham sandwiches to these two.
I compared it to, like, animal crackers.
Oh, there you go.
A feast of animal crackers.
I like that, yeah. Yeah, so there's that, but also that term unleavened bread as a feast right before he comes out of a city that's going to be destroyed.
Right.
I mean, that seems pretty clear.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's developing this pattern, right?
Yeah, so we're looking at the Passover now. So as he's showing this meager hospitality, but still hospitality and loyalty nonetheless, to these two men, the inhabitants of Sodom come out to rape these newcomers, to take them, and it says to know them. And it's got those sexual connotations there. And the story makes a point to say that all the men of Sodom came out. What was the previous narrative about? Well, Abraham's like, if you find 50, 40, 30, 20, 10 people there that are righteous, will you spare the city? Well, every last one of them came out.
Yeah, so there are not 10 righteous in the city.
There's one, and even he's hanging by a thread. It's
in the city. Right. And there's a debate on that whether, like, is Lot... The only reason I think that we could even maybe say that Lot is a righteous man is because Peter in the New Testament talks about him as a righteous man.
Yeah, that's the only reason we'd think of it.
Yeah, that's the only reason we would think of it, because, I mean, the rest of Lot's story is just like he's just foolish over and over. And the end of the story, like we're going to see, I mean, it doesn't end well for him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he kind of has the picture of a kid that's doing everything wrong, but ultimately his loyalty is still to his parents. You know, he's still loyal to Yahweh, even though everything else he's doing wrong.
Yeah. Now, I do think his unity with Abraham, like that he's part of Abraham's family, and that, and even the text here says that that God saved Lot because he remembered Abraham.
Yeah. This is all an outworking of Abraham's intercession for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in that we do learn a bit about the benefit of being part of the family of the elect one.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, obviously there's some typological stuff pointing towards Jesus there, as we're part of Jesus' family, and he gives deliverance to us through his intercession with the Father and all those things.
Right. Well, and up to this point, the only person that's been labeled as righteous as a human has been
Noah.
Abraham. Oh, no, yeah, you're right. Two people, Abraham, Noah, and then Abraham was counted as righteous.
Yeah.
And it even, like Peter goes on to talk about how that Lot, like you said, was righteous in the one righteous in that city, or the most righteous in that city, and that it drove him nuts that that he had to deal with these wicked men.
Right.
And so, yeah, in a sense, just like Noah was righteous in his generation, doesn't mean he was perfect, but compared to everybody else, he looked pretty good.
Yeah, he still, even though imperfectly, was trying to aim towards righteousness and try to bring about what Yahweh's plans were for the world, even though, again, he had very uninformed and bad instincts on how to do that.
Yeah, and it does seem like he's, over the years, become more and more influenced by the wickedness of Sodom. I mean, the fact that he's a prominent man there, he's got daughters who have married men of the city, and his wife obviously had fallen in love with the city. And so we'll get to that here in a little bit, though.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll keep going with his story. So ultimately, he does show loyalty to Yahweh's servants. He brings them in, and then whenever the men of the city come out and they want to take them, he tries to protect them. He comes out and he shuts the door behind him and pleads with them, but you know they're just not going to have it. What Lot does, he did well in trying to defend them, and then he offers his daughters to them instead of these men. And obviously, that's the bad part, that you're like, "What, Lot? What are you doing?"
Right.
A for effort, but
well, and again, I think this may be Lot being kind of a product of his culture,
right?
Especially in that culture, if like women who are not of age to marry, like if they're low on the totem pole as far as in their society, they're looked at as a product or that you can bargain with, you know.
Well, and I think it might be good to mention here. So there's another really good podcast doing something similar to what we're doing, called Bible Talk with Jim Hamilton and Sam Amati, and they're they started in Genesis, and they're not going as granular as we are on some things in Genesis, but they're just going chapter by chapter through the Old Testament. I think they're in like Kings right now.
Yeah.
But he was just mentioning the other day because of something similar to this in the Book of Kings, where we may look back on previous generations and their sins. And, I mean, what he did here is horrible, but be quick to condemn them for the sins that are common within that generation and not for the ones that are common in our generation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah.
If we were in his shoes, who knows, we may have tried the same tactic.
Yeah. We might've thought that was a good idea.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, that's a challenge us in our own context to evaluate the way that we, the first thing I think of is how we use our resources and just question, is this the right way to go? Is this okay? Or is it something that ultimately, if we look back, or a different culture looks on us and it's something that they would be appalled at?
Right. Oh yeah, absolutely. I think some of the things that we do on a normal basis that we don't even think of, that the ancient world would think were complete heretics and sinners. And,
right.
So that being said, I do think we're meant to see Lot handing over or trying to hand over his daughters. We're meant to see that as deplorable. I mean, it's not a good thing.
Yeah. So someone that is loyal to Yahweh, but being saved by grace. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay. He has gone out of his door to defend these men, even in a flawed way, and he shut the door behind him to defend these men. When the men of Sodom start to press against Lot and try to force their way in, the angels, they grab Lot, pull him in, and then they shut the door to protect him.
Right, right.
So just an instant reversal. They turn the tables, and as soon as they see Lot's loyalty to them to this extent, they begin defending him and shut him in, just like Yahweh, you said, shut Noah in the ark.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there's actually a really cool link between this and the Passover as well, and Noah's flood, potentially. I'm not 100% on this, but so the word Passover in the Old Testament is Pesach.
Right.
And there's a good case. Meredith Klein has put out an article I think makes the best case for this. But that word Pesach could be better translated as to cover over instead of to pass over. I will pass through the land of Egypt, and I will cover over you and not destroy your firstborn. And so it's rather a protective thing rather than Yahweh passing over.
Right.
So, again, in a conceptual way, Yahweh is covering and shutting them in here. So the article for the meaning of the word is convincing, but I think there might be a loose link there.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Very interesting.
And it would make sense, though, too, because we're in this giant Exodus framework in the story. And
right.
So we have kind of a Passover event where someone's being protected behind a door, his family's being protected behind the door, while the rest are struck in the next verse. In verse 11, they're all struck. And that word, it's nacha. And that's used throughout the Exodus story to refer to Egypt being struck. See that in Exodus 3:20, in 7:25, throughout chapter 9, that word's used to refer to Egypt being struck. And they're struck with blindness. And that might point to the darkness that the Egyptians face.
Right, right.
Maybe. Again, that's another conceptual link. And I'm always a little bit leery of conceptual links, but if they stack up and there's a lot of conceptual links and other literary links and contextual links all mixed together, then there might be something to those conceptual links.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
But if you're looking for those links in the text and you do find just some similarities and conceptual links between passages, but there's nothing else really linking them, be wary of those. There are a lot of people who like to very quickly just draw a link and then like, ooh, I found something, and then it leads them down a very bad road when it comes to interpretation.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, so we have Lot shut the door, the angels take him in and they shut the door, and then they, you know, are protecting him in this Passover-like way, possibly. Then they strike the men of Sodom, just like Yahweh struck Egypt with blindness, possibly just like Yahweh struck Egypt with darkness. And then this household is able to come out.
In Exodus.
Yeah. Then those in Lot's household are invited to come out of an Exodus, including his Sodomite sons-in-law.
But they don't.
Yeah.
They choose not to.
Yeah, they don't take him seriously. They don't think God's actually going to destroy the city.
Yeah. Yeah, and when I was studying that passage, I know a lot of our translations talk about it being like they thought he was jesting. But the word is a word that is typically used to describe not just a jest, but like an offensive, like a mocking. And I think even the King James Version uses that phrase. Yeah, so the King James Version is, but he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. I don't know for sure if that's what's going on here, but I thought it was interesting that the King James Version interpreted it that way.
That word there, I mean, usually translated laughing in this verbal form, joking or jesting makes sense, but there's like this negative connotation to it throughout Genesis in a lot of places.
Yeah.
There are places where it, I think, has a neutral connotation, but throughout the book of Genesis, it seems to be used more in that way.
Right.
So yeah, Lot and his sons-in-laws and his daughters, and his wife actually, they've all been invited to take an exodus out of this city because, the angels say in verse 13, because there is an outcry against its people. And so Yahweh sent them to destroy it. And that word outcry is also used, I mean, throughout the Exodus motif in Genesis and in the Exodus story, there is an outcry in Genesis 2:23 of the Israelites against Egypt, and in a couple times in chapter 3 of Exodus as well, but it's also used other places in the Exodus motif in Genesis. So we have here's the oppressive city causing an outcry that goes up to Yahweh, and he hears it and comes to see and to know and to deliver.
Yeah, and I think that's important because I think often when we think of Sodom, we only think of sexual sin, and that's absolutely a big part of who Sodom, like their identity, that we see in the Bible, and you even see that in the New Testament too, as mentioned. But I think it's also important that, like Ezekiel 16, where the Israelites are being compared to Sodom. In fact, it says, "Your sister Sodom and her daughters have not done as you and your daughters have done. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and the needy. They were haughty and did an abomination before me." And so you see that, and that word abomination is, I think, referring to sexual sin.
Genesis 19.
That's referring to sexual sin there. Mm-hmm. But you can see in that passage that there was more going on than just the sexual sin. They were oppressing the poor. They weren't helping the poor. They were haughty. And so there's definitely some, just a whole lot of pride. And you know that you see the source of it too. It's they had an excess and they were prosperous and they had too much ease. Mm-hmm. And that led to a lot of other sins.
Yeah. Yeah. Just pride and indulgence leading to oppression and neglect.
Yeah. So
I think that probably sums up Sodom pretty well.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, all of this indulgence and neglect and oppression leads to this outcry that Yahweh and his servants come to hear, and so that they can know if it's true or not, and if it's true, they're going to destroy the city. And that word, again, destroy, is the same word used throughout the Exodus story to refer to the destruction of Egypt. We have that in Exodus 8:24 and in chapter 12, verse 13 and 23, just if you want to look it up.
Is that the same word that's used back in the flood also?
Yep. First occurrence of the word in the Bible is in chapter 6 of Genesis, and then used again a couple times in chapter 9, talking about, "I'm going to bring a flood of waters on the earth to destroy all flesh, and then I shall never use a flood to destroy the land or to destroy all flesh."
Right.
So yeah,
a lot of parallels.
Another link to Noah.
Yep.
Very cool.